the message continued, and he'll discover it when he gets back. And I thought, this is my idea, subject to your correction, that we'd take a trip out there later in the week just to be sure he's not rebuilding. Some of these independent operators are sort of screwy, like those guys last year that tried to set up their own telephone system. Anyhow, I believe that takes care of it. And by the way, he was using Norb Steiner's old gear. We found records around with Steiner's name on them. So you were right. It's a good thing we moved right on to this guy, because he would have been trouble. The message ended. Arnie put the reel on his encoder, seated himself at the mic, and answered. Scott, you did good. Thanks. I trust we've heard the last from that guy, and I approve your confiscating his stock. We can use it all. Drop by some evening and have a drink. He stopped the mechanism then and rewound the reel. From the kitchen came the insistent, muffled sound of Heliogabalus reading aloud to Manfred Steiner. Hearing it, Arnie felt irritation, and then his resentment toward the Bleakman surged up. "Why'd you let me get mixed up with Jack Bolin when he could read the kid's mind?" he demanded. "Why didn't you speak up?" He felt outright hatred for Heliogabalus. "You betrayed me, too," he said to himself, "like the rest of them, Anne and Jack and Doreen, all of them." Going to the kitchen door, he yelled in, "You getting results, or aren't you?" Heliogabalus lowered his book and said, "Mister, this requires time and effort." "Time," Arnie said. "Hell, that's the whole problem. Send him back into the past, say 2 years ago, and have him buy the Henry Wallace in my name. Can you do that?" There was no answer. The question, to Heliogabalus, was too absurd even to consider. Flushing, Arnie slammed the kitchen door shut and stalked back into the living room. "And have him send me back into the past," Arnie said to himself. "This time-travel ability must be worth something. Why can't I get the kind of results I want? What's the matter with everyone?" "They're just making me wait to annoy me," he said to himself. "And," he decided, "I'm not going to wait much longer." By 1 o'clock in the afternoon, still no service calls had come in from the E Company. Jack Bolin, waiting by the phone in Doreen Anderton's apartment, knew that something was wrong. At 1:30, he phoned Mr. Yee. "I assume that Mr. Cott would inform you, Jack," Mr. Yee said in his prosaic manner. "You are no longer my employee, Jack. You are his. Thank you for your fine service record." Demoralized by the news, Jack said, "Cott bought my contract?" "That is the case, Jack." Jack hung up the phone. "What did he say?" Doreen asked, watching him wide-eyed. "I'm Arnie's." "What's he going to do?" "I don't know," he said. "I guess I better call him and find out. It doesn't look as if he's going to call me." "Playing with me," he thought. "Sadistic games. Enjoying himself, perhaps." "There's no use telephoning him," Doreen said. "He never says anything on the phone. We'll have to go over to his place. I want to go along. Please let me." "Okay," he said, going to the closet to get his coat. "Let's go," he said to her. Chapter 14. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Otto Zitti poked his head out the side door of the Bolin house and ascertained that no one was watching. He could leave safely, Sylvia Bolin realized as she saw what he was doing. "What have I done?" she asked herself as she stood in the middle bedroom, clumsily buttoning her blouse. "How can I expect to keep it secret? Even if Mrs. Steiner doesn't see him, he'll surely tell that June Hennessy, and she'll blab it to everybody along the William Butler Yeats. She loves gossip. I know Jack will find out, and Leo might have come home early." But it was too late now, over and done with. Otto was gathering up his suitcases, preparing to depart. "I wish I was dead," she said to herself. "Goodbye, Sylvia," Otto said hurriedly as he started toward the front door. "I will call you." She did not answer. She concentrated on putting on her shoes. "Aren't you going to say goodbye?" he asked, pausing at the bedroom door. Shooting a glance at him, she said, "No, and get out of here. Don't ever come back. I hate you, I really do." He shrugged. "Why?" "Because," she said with perfect logic, "you're a horrible person. I never had anything to do with a person like you before. I must be out of my mind. It must be the loneliness." He seemed genuinely hurt. Flushed red, he hung around at the doorway of the bedroom. That was as much your idea as mine, he mumbled finally, glaring at her. Go away, she said, turning her back to him. At last the front door opened and shut. He had gone. Never, never again, Sylvia said to herself. She went to the medicine cabinet in the bathroom and got down her bottle of phenobarbital. Hastily pouring herself a glass of water, she took 150 milligrams, gulping them down and gasping. I shouldn't have been so mean to him, she realized in a flash of conscience. It wasn't fair. It wasn't really his fault. It was mine. If I'm no good, why blame him? If it hadn't been him, it would have been someone else sooner or later. She thought, will he ever come back? Or have I driven him off forever? Already she felt lonely, unhappy, and completely at a loss once more, as if she were doomed to drift in a hopeless vacuum forever and ever. He was actually very nice, she decided. Gentle and considerate. I could have done a lot worse. Going into the kitchen, she seated herself at the table, picked up the telephone, and dialed June Hennessy's number. Presently, June's voice sounded in her ear. Hello? Sylvia said, guess what? Tell me. Wait till I light a cigarette. Sylvia Boland lit a cigarette, got an ashtray, moved her chair so that she was comfortable, and then, with an infinitude of detail, plus a little essential invention at critical points, she told her. To her surprise, she found the telling to be as enjoyable as the experience itself. Perhaps even a bit more so. Flying back across the desert to his base in the FDR Mountains, Otto Zitti ruminated on his assignation with Mrs. Boland and congratulated himself. He was in a good mood, despite Sylvia's not unnatural fit of remorse and accusation just as he was leaving. You have to expect that, he advised himself. It had happened before. True, it always upset him, but that was one of the odd little tricks typical of a woman's mind. There always came a point when they had to sidestep reality and start casting blame in all directions toward anyone and anything handy. He did not much care. Nothing could rob him of the memory of the happy time which the two of them had engaged in. So now what? Back to the field to have lunch, rest up, shave, shower, and change his clothes? It would still be time enough to start out once more on an authentic selling trip with nothing else in mind this time but pure business itself. Already he could see the ragged peaks of the mountains ahead. He would soon be there. It seemed to him that he saw a plume of ugly gray smoke drifting up from the mountains directly ahead. Frightened, he stepped up the velocity of the copter. No doubt of it, the smoke rose at or near his field. They found me, he said to himself with a sob. The UN, they wiped me out and they're waiting for me. But he went on anyhow. He had to know for sure. Below lay the remains of his field, a smoking, rubble-strewn ruin. He circled aimlessly, crying openly, tears spilling down his cheeks. There was no sign of the UN, however, no military vehicles or soldiers. Could an incoming rocket have exploded? Quickly, Otto landed the copter. On foot, he ran across the hot ground toward the debris that had been his storage shed. As he reached the signal tower of the field, he saw pinned to it a square of cardboard. Arnie Kott doesn't like what you stand for. Again and again he read it, trying to understand it. Arnie Kott? He was just getting ready to call on him. Arnie had been Norb's best customer. What did this mean? Had he already provided poor service to Arnie? Or how else had he made Arnie mad? It didn't make sense. What had he done to Arnie Kott to deserve this? Why? Otto asked. What did I do to you? Why have you destroyed me? Presently he made his way over to the shed, hoping beyond hope that some of the stocks could be salvaged, hoping to find something among the remains. There were no remains. The stock had been taken. He saw no single can, glass jar, package, or bag. The litter of the building itself, yes, but only that. Then they, those who had dropped the bomb, had come in first and pilfered the stock. You bombed me, Arnie Kott, and you stole my goods, Otto said as he wandered in a circle, clenching and unclenching his fists and darting glances of rage and frenzy up at the sky. And still he did not understand why. There had to be a reason, he said to himself. And I will find it out. I will not rest, God damn you, Arnie Kott, until I know. And when I find out, I will get you. I will pay you back for what you did. He blew his nose, snuffled, dragged himself back to his copter with slow steps, seated himself inside, and stared ahead for a long, long time. At last he opened one of the suitcases. From it he took the .22-caliber pistol. He sat holding it on his lap, thinking about Arne Kot. To Arne Kot, Heliogabalus said, "Mister, excuse me for disturbing you, but if you are ready, I will explain to you what you must do." Delighted, Arne stopped at his desk. "Fire away." With a sad and haughty expression on his face, Helio said, "You must take Manfred out into the desert and cross, on foot, to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Mountains. There your pilgrimage must end when you bring the boy to Dirty Nobby, the rock which is sacred to the Bleakmen. Your answer lies there when you have introduced the boy to Dirty Nobby." Wagging his finger at the tame Bleakman, Arne said slyly, "And you told me it was a fraud." He had felt all the time that there was something to the Bleakman religion. Helio had tried to deceive him. "At the sanctuary of the rock you must commune. The spirit which animates Dirty Nobby will receive your collective psyches, and perhaps, if it is merciful, it will grant what you request." Helio added, "It is in actuality the capacity within the boy which you must depend on. The rock alone is powerless. However, it is as follows. Time is weakest at that spot where Dirty Nobby lies. Upon that fact, the Bleakman has prevailed for centuries." "I see," Arne said, "a sort of puncture in time, and you guys get at the future through it. Well, it's the past I'm interested in now, and frankly, this all sounds fishy to me, but I'll try it. You've told me so many different yarns about that rock." Helio said, "What I said before is true. Alone, Dirty Nobby could have done nothing for you." He did not cringe. He met Arnie's gaze. "You think Manfred will cooperate?" "I have told him of the rock, and he is excited at the idea of seeing it. I said that in that place one might escape backward into the past. That idea enthralls him. However..." Helio paused. "You must repay the boy for his effort. You can offer him something of priceless value. Mister, you can banish the specter of Amweb from his life forever. Promise him that you will send him back to Earth. Then, no matter what becomes of him, he will never see the interior of that abominable building. If you do that for him, he will turn all his mental powers in your behalf."
"It sounds fine to me," Arne said.
"And you will not fail the boy?"
"Oh, heck no," Arne promised. "I'll make all the arrangements with the UN right away. It's complicated, but I got lawyers who can handle stuff like that without even half trying."
"Good," Helio said, nodding. "It would be foul to let the boy down. If you could for a moment experience his terrible anxiety about his future life in that place."
"Yeah, it sounds awful," Arne agreed.
"What a shame it would be," Helio said, eyeing him, "if you yourself did ever have to endure that."
"Where is Manfred right now?"
"He is walking about the streets of Lewistown," Helio said, "taking in the sights."
"Cripes, is it safe?"
"I think so," Helio said. "He is much excited by the people and stores and activity. It is all new to him."
"You sure have helped that kid," Arne said. The door chimes sounded, and Helio went to answer. When Arne looked up, there stood Jack Bolin and Doreen Anderton, both of them with fixed, high-strung expressions.
"Oh, hi," Arne said, preoccupied. "Come on in. I was about to call you, Jack. Listen, I got a job for you."
Jack Bolin said, "Why did you buy my contract from Mr. Yee?"
"Because I need you," Arne said. "I'll tell you why right now. I'm going on a pilgrimage with Manfred, and I want somebody to circle around overhead so we don't get lost and die of thirst. We got to walk across the desert to the FDR Mountains. Isn't that right, Helio?"
"Yes, mister," Helio said.
"I want to get started right away," Arne explained. "I figure it's about a 5-day hike. We'll take a portable communications rig with us so we can notify you when we need something like food or water. At night you can land the copter and pitch a tent for us to sleep in. Make sure you get medical supplies on board in case either Manfred or I get bit by a desert animal. I hear there's Martian snakes and rats running around wild out there."
He examined his watch. "It's 3 now.
I'd like to get started by 4 and get in maybe 5 hours tonight.
What's the purpose of this pilgrimage? Doreen asked presently.
I got business out there to attend to, Arnie said. Out among those desert bleakmen. Private business.
Are you coming along in the copter?
If so, you better put on something different, maybe boots and heavy pants, because it's always possible you fellas might get forced down.
That's a long time, 5 days, to keep circling. Make sure in particular about the water.
Doreen and Jack looked at each other.
I'm serious, Arnie said, so let's not stop to mess around, okay?
As far as I can tell, Jack said to Doreen, I have no choice. I have to do what he tells me.
That's the truth, buddy, Arnie agreed. So start rounding up the equipment we'll need. Portable stove to cook on, portable light, portable bathroom, food and soap and towels, a gun of some sort. You know what we'll need. You've been living on the edge of the desert.
Jack nodded slowly. What is this business? Doreen said. And why do you have to walk? If you have to go there, why can't you fly as you usually do?
I just have to walk, Arnie said with irritation. That's the way it is. It wasn't my idea.
To Helio, he said, I can fly back, can't I?
Yes, mister, Helio said. You may return any way you prefer.
It's a good thing I'm in top-notch physical shape, Arnie said, or this would be out of the question. I hope Manfred can make it.
He is quite strong, mister, Helio said.
You're taking the boy, Jack murmured.
That's right, Arnie said. Any objections?
Jack Boland did not answer, but he looked more grim than ever. Suddenly he burst out,
You can't make the boy walk for 5 days across the desert. It'll kill him.
Why can't you go in some surface vehicle? Doreen asked. One of those little tractor jitneys that the UN post office people use to deliver the mail. It would still take a long time. It would still be a pilgrimage.
What about that? Arnie said to Helio.
After some reflection, the bleakman said, I suppose that little cart of which you speak would do.
Fine, Arnie said, deciding then and there. I'll phone a couple of guys I know and pick up one of those P.O. jitneys.
That's a good idea you gave me, Doreen. I appreciate it. Of course, you two still have to be there overhead to make sure we don't break down.
Both Jack and Doreen nodded.
Maybe when I get there where I'm going, Arnie said, you'll maybe find out what I'm up to.
In fact, you darn well are going to, he said to himself. There's no doubt about that.
This is all very strange, Doreen said. She stood close to Jack Boland, holding onto his arm.
Don't blame me, Arnie said. Blame Helio.
He grinned.
That is true, Helio said. It was my idea.
But their expressions remained.
Talk to your dad yet today? Arnie asked Jack.
Yes, briefly on the phone.
His claim filed now, all recorded, no hitches?
Jack said, He says it was properly processed. He's preparing to return to Earth.
Efficient operation, Arnie said. I admire that. Shows up here on Mars, stakes out his claim, goes to the abstract office and records it, then flies back. Not bad.
What are you up to, Arnie? Jack said in a quiet voice.
Arnie shrugged. I got this holy pilgrimage to make along with Manfred, that's all.
He was, however, still grinning. He could not help it. He could not stop, and he did not bother to try.
Use of the UN post office jitney cut the proposed pilgrimage from Lewistown to Dirty Nobby from 5 days to a mere 8 hours, or so Arnie calculated.
Nothing to do now but go, he said to himself as he paced about his living room.
Outside the building at the curb, Helio sat in the parked jitney with Manfred. Through the window, Arnie could see them far below. He got his gun from his desk drawer, strapped it on inside his coat, locked up the desk, and hurried out into the hall. A moment later, he emerged on the sidewalk and made for the jitney.
Here we go, he said to Manfred.
Helio stepped from the jitney, and Arnie seated himself behind the tiller. He revved up the tiny turbine engine. It made a noise like a bumblebee in a bottle.
Sounds good, he said heartily. So long, Helio. If this goes off okay, there's a reward for you. Remember that.
I expect no reward, Helio said. I am only doing my duty by you, mister. I would do it for anyone.
Releasing the parking brake, Arnie pulled out into the downtown Lewistown late afternoon traffic.
They were on their way. Overhead, Jack Bolin and Doreen were no doubt cruising in the copter. Arnie did not bother to search for sign of them, taking it for granted that they were there. He waved goodbye to Helio, and then a huge tractor bus filled in all the space behind the jitney. Helio was cut off from view.
"How about this, Manfred?" Arnie said as he guided the jitney toward the perimeter of Lewistown and the desert beyond.
"Isn't this something? It makes almost 50 miles an hour, and that isn't hay."
The boy did not respond, but his body trembled with excitement.
"This is the nuts," Arnie declared in answer to his own query.
They had almost left Lewistown when Arnie became aware of a car which had pulled up beside them and was proceeding at the same speed as theirs. He saw, within the car, two figures, a man and a woman. At first he thought it was Jack and Doreen, and then he discovered that the woman was his ex-wife, Ann Esterhazy, and the man was Dr. Milton Glaub.
"What the hell do they want?" Arnie wondered. "Can't they see I'm busy? I can't be bothered, whatever it is."
"Caught!" Dr. Glaub yelled. "Pull over to the curb so we can talk to you. This is vital!"
"The hell!" Arnie said, increasing the speed of the jitney. He felt with his left hand for his gun.
"I got nothing to say, and what are you two doing in cahoots?"
He didn't like the look of it one bit.
"Just like them to gang up," he said to himself. "I should have expected it." Snapping on the portable communications rig, he put in a call to his steward, Eddie Goggins, at Union Hall.
"This is Arnie. My gyro compass point is 8.45702, right at the edge of town. Get over here quick. I got a party that has to be took care of. Make it fast. They're gaining on me."
They had, in fact, never fallen behind. It was easy for them to match the speed of the little jitney, and even to exceed it.
"Will do, Arnie," Eddie Goggins said. "I'll send some of the boys on the double. Don't worry."
Now the car edged ahead and drew toward the curb. Arnie reluctantly slowed the jitney to a stop. The car placed itself in a position to block escape, and then Glaub jumped from it and scuttled up crab-like to the jitney, waving his arms.
"This ends your career of bullying and domineering," he shouted at Arnie.
"He riced," Arnie thought, "at a time like this. What do you want?" he said. "Make it snappy. I got business."
"Leave Jack Bolin alone," Dr. Glaub panted. "I represent him, and he needs rest and quiet. You'll have to deal with me."
From the car, Ann Esterhazy emerged. She approached the jitney and confronted Arnie.
"As I understand the situation," she began.
"You understand nothing," Arnie said with venom. "Let me by, or I'll take care of both of you." Overhead, a copter with the Water Workers' Union marking on it appeared and began to descend. It was Jack and Doreen, Arnie guessed. And behind it came a second copter at tremendous speed. That, no doubt, was Eddie and the good members. Both copters prepared to land close by.
Ann Esterhazy said, "Arnie, I know that something bad is going to happen to you if you don't stop what you're doing."
"To me?" he said, amused and incredulous.
"I feel it. Please, Arnie, whatever it is you're up to, think twice. There's so much good in the world. Must you have your revenge?"
"Go back to New Israel and tend your goddamn store."
He fast idled the motor of the jitney.
"That boy," Ann said. "That's Manfred Steiner, isn't it? Let Milton take him back to Camp DG. It's better for everyone, better for him and for you."
One of the copters had landed. From it hopped three or four WWU men. They came running up the street, and Dr. Glaub, seeing them, plucked dolefully at Ann's sleeve.
"I see them." She remained unruffled.
"Please, Arnie, you and I have worked together so often on so many worthwhile things. For my sake, for Sam's sake. If you go ahead with this, I know you and I will never be together again in any way whatever. Can't you feel that? Is this so important as all that to lose so much?"
Arnie said nothing. Puffing, Eddie Goggins appeared beside the jitney. The Union men fanned out toward Ann Esterhazy and Dr. Glaub. Now the other copter had landed, and from it stepped Jack Bolin.
"Ask him," Arnie said. "He's coming of his own free will. He's a grown man. He knows what he's doing. Ask him if he isn't voluntarily coming along on this pilgrimage."
As Glaub and Ann Esterhazy turned toward Jack, Arnie Cott backed up the jitney. He shifted into forward and shot around the side of the parked car. A scuffle broke out as Glaub tried to get back into the car. Two good members grabbed him and they wrestled. Arnie steered the jitney straight ahead, and the car and the people fell behind.
"Here we go," he said to Manfred.
Ahead, the street became a vague level strip passing from the city out onto the desert, in the direction of the hills far beyond. The jitney bumped along at near top speed, and Arnie smiled. Beside him, the boy's face shone with excitement.
"Nobody can stop me," Arnie said to himself.
The sounds of the squabble faded from his ears. He heard now only the buzz of the tiny turbine of the jitney. He settled back.
"Dirty Nobby, get ready," he said to himself.
And then he thought of Jack Boland's magic charm, the water witch, which Helio said the man had on him, and Arnie frowned. But the frown was momentary. He did not slow down. Beside him, Manfred crowed excitedly,
"Gobble, gobble!"
"What's that mean, gobble, gobble?" Arnie asked.
There was no answer as the two of them bounced along in the UN post office jitney toward the FDR Mountains directly ahead.
"Maybe I'll find out what it means when we get there," Arnie said to himself. "I'd like to know." For some reason, the sounds which the boy made, the unintelligible words, made him nervous, more so than anything else. He wished suddenly that Helio was along.
"Gobble, gobble!"
Manfred cried as they sped along. Chapter 15. The black, lopsided projection of sandstone and volcanic glass, which was Dirty Nobby, poked up huge and gaunt ahead of them in the glow of early morning. They had spent the night on the desert in a tent, the copter parked close by. Jack Boland and Doreen Anderton had exchanged no words with them. At dawn, the copter had taken off to circle overhead. Arnie and the boy Manfred Steiner had eaten a good breakfast and then packed up and resumed their trip. Now the trip, the pilgrimage to the sacred rock of the Bleakman, was over. Seeing Dirty Nobby close up like this, Arnie thought, "There's the place that'll cure us all of whatever ails us." Letting Manfred take the tiller of the jitney, he consulted the map which Helio Gabalus had drawn. It showed the path up into the range to the rock. There was, Helio had told him, a hollowed-out chamber on the north side of the rock where a Bleakman priest could generally be found. "Unless," Arnie said to himself, "he's off somewhere sleeping off a binge." He knew the Bleakman priests. They were old winos for the most part. Even the Bleakman had contempt for them. At the base of the first hill in the shadows, he parked the jitney and shut off its engine. "From here we climb on foot," he said to Manfred. "We'll carry as much gear as we can, food and water, naturally, and the communications rig, and I guess if we need to cook, we can come back for the stove. It's only supposed to be a few more miles." The boy hopped from the jitney. He and Arnie unloaded the gear, and soon they were trudging up the rocky trail into the FDR range. Glancing about with apprehension, Manfred huddled and shivered. Perhaps the boy was experiencing AmWeb once more, Arnie conjectured. The Henry Wallace was only 100 miles from here. The boy might well have picked up the emanations of the structure to come, close as they were now. In fact, he could almost feel them himself. Or was it the rock of the Bleakman which he felt? He did not like the sight of it. "Why make a shrine out of this?" he asked himself. Perverse, this arid place. But maybe a long time ago this region had been fertile. Evidence of one-time Bleakman camps could be made out along the path. Maybe the Martians had originated here. The land certainly had an old, used appearance. As if, he thought, a million gray-black creatures had handled all this throughout the ages. And now what was it? A last remains for a dying race. A relic for those who were not going to be around much longer. Wheezing from the exertion of climbing with a heavy load, Arnie halted. Manfred toiled up the steep acclivity after him, still casting anxiety-stricken looks around. "Don't worry," Arnie said encouragingly. "There's nothing here to be scared of." Was the boy's talent already blending with that of the rock? And, he wondered, had the rock itself become apprehensive too? Was it capable of that? The trail leveled out and became wider, and all was in shadow. Cold and damp hung over everything, as if they were treading within a great tomb. The vegetation that grew thin and noxious along the surface of rocks had a dead quality to it, as if something had poisoned it in its act of growing. Ahead lay a dead bird on the path, a rotten corpse that might have been there for weeks. He could not tell. It had a mummified appearance. "I sure don't enjoy this place," Arnie said to himself. Halting at the bird, Manfred bent down and said, "Gubbish." "Yeah," Arnie murmured. "Come on, let's go." They arrived all at once at the base of the rock. Wind rustled the leaves of vegetation, the shrubs, which looked as if they had been skinned down to their elements, bare and picked over like bones stuck upright in the soil. The wind emerged from a crack in Dirty Nobby, and it smelled, he thought, as if some sort of animal lived there. Maybe the priest himself. He saw with no real surprise an empty wine bottle lying off to one side, with other bits of debris caught on the sharp foliage nearby. "Anybody around?" Arnie called. After a long time, an old man, a bleakman, gray as if wrapped in webs, edged out of the chamber within the rock. The wind seemed to blow him along so that he crept sideways, pausing against the side of the cavity and then stirring forward once more. His eyes were red-rimmed. "You old drunk," Arnie said in a low voice. And then, from a piece of paper Helio had given him, he greeted the old man in bleaky. The priest mumbled a toothless, mechanical response. "Here." Arnie held out a carton of cigarettes. The priest, mumbling, sidled forward and took the carton in his claws. He tucked the carton beneath his gray-webbed robes. "You like that, huh?" Arnie said. "I thought you would." From the piece of paper he read in bleaky the purpose of his visit and what he wanted the priest to do. He wanted the priest to leave him and Manfred in peace for an hour or so at the chamber so that they could summon the spirit of the rock. Still mumbling, the priest backed away, fussed with the hem of his robes, then turned and shambled off. He disappeared down a side trail without a backward look at Arnie and Manfred. Arnie turned the paper over and read the instructions that Helio had written out. 1. Enter chamber. Taking Manfred by the arm, he led him step by step into the dark cleft of the rock. Flashing on his light, he led the boy along until the chamber became large. It still smelled bad, he thought, as if it had been kept closed up for centuries, like an old box full of decayed rags, a vegetable rather than animal scent. Now what? Again he consulted Helio's paper. 2. Light fire. An uneven ring of boulders surrounded a blackened pit in which lay fragments of wood and what appeared to be bones. It looked as if the old wino fixed his meals here. In his pack, Arnie had kindling. He got it out now, laying the pack on the floor of the cavern and fumbling stiff-fingered with the straps. "Don't get lost, kid," he said to Manfred. "I wonder if we're ever coming out of here again," he asked himself. Both of them felt better, however, when the fire had been lit. The cavern became warmer, but not dry. The smell of mold persisted, and even seemed to become stronger, as if the fire were attracting it, whatever it was. The next instruction bewildered him. It did not seem to fit in, but nonetheless he complied. 3. Turn on portable radio to 574 kilocycles. Arnie got out the little Japanese-made transistor portable and turned it on. At 574 kilocycles, nothing but static issued forth. It seemed, though, to obtain a response from the rock around them. The rock seemed to change and become more alert, as if the noise from the radio had wakened it to their presence. The next instruction was equally annoying. 4. Take Nebutol, boy not take. Using the canteen, Arnie swallowed the Nebutol down, wondering if its purpose was to blur his senses and make him credulous, or was it to stifle his anxiety. Only one instruction remained. 5. Throw enclosed packet on fire. Helio had put into Arnie's pack a small paper, a wadded-up page from the New York Times with some kind of grass within it. Kneeling by the fire, Arnie carefully unwrapped the packet and dumped the dark, dry strands into the flames. A nauseating smell arose and the flames died down. Smoke billowed out, filling the chamber. He heard Manfred cough. "God damn," Arnie thought, "it'll kill us yet if we keep on." The smoke disappeared almost at once. The cavern seemed now dark and empty and much larger than before, as if the rock around them had receded. He felt all at once as if he were going to fall. He seemed no longer to be standing precisely upright. Sense of balance gone, he realized. Nothing to use as bearing. "Manfred," he said, "now listen. On account of me, you don't have to worry about that amweb anymore, like Helio explained. You got that? Okay, now, regress back around 3 weeks. Can you do that? Really put your back into it. Try hard as you can." In the gloom, the boy peeped at him, eyes wide with fear. "Back to before I knew Jack Bolan," Arnie said.
Before I met him out on the desert that day, those bleakmen were dying of thirst. You get it?
He walked toward the boy. He fell flat on his face. The Nembutal, he thought. Better get back up before I pass out entirely. He struggled up, groping for something to catch on to. Light flared, seared him. He put his hands, and then he was in water. Warm water pouring over him, over his face. He spluttered, choked, saw around him billowing steam, felt beneath his feet familiar tile. He was in his steam bath. Voices of men conversing, Eddie's voice saying, "Right, Arnie?" Then the outline of shapes around him, other men taking showers. Down inside him, near his groin, his duodenal ulcer began to burn, and he realized that he was terribly hungry. He stepped from the shower and, with weak, unwilling legs, padded across the warm, wet tiles, searching for the attendant so that he could get his great terry-cloth bath towel. "I've been here before," he thought. "I've done all this, said what I'm going to say. It's uncanny. What do they call it? French word. Better get some breakfast." His stomach rumbled, and the ulcer pain increased. "Hey, Tom," he called to the attendant, "dry me off and get me dressed so I can go eat. My ulcer's killing me." He had never felt such pain from it before. "Right, Arnie," the attendant said, stepping toward him, holding out the huge, soft white towel. When he had been dressed by the attendant in his gray flannel trousers and T-shirt, soft leather boots, and nautical cap, good member Arnie Cott left the steam bath and crossed the corridor of the Union Hall to his dining room, where Heliogabalus had his breakfast waiting. At last he sat before a stack of hotcakes and bacon, genuine home coffee, a glass of orange juice from New Israel Oranges, and the previous week's New York Times, the Sunday edition. He trembled with consternation as he reached to pick up the glass of chilled, strained, sweet orange juice. The glass was slippery and smooth to the touch and almost eluded him in mid-trip. He thought, "I have to be careful. Slow down and take it easy. It's really so. I'm back here where I was several weeks ago. Manfred and the Rock of the Bleakmen did it together." Wow, he thought, his mind a hubbub of anticipation. This is something. He sipped at the orange juice, enjoying each swallow of it until the glass had been emptied. "I got what I wanted," he said to himself. "Now I have to be careful," he told himself. "There's some things I sure don't want to change. I want to be sure I don't foul up my black market business by doing the natural thing and interfering so that old Norb Steiner doesn't take his own life. I mean, it's sad about him, but I don't intend to get out of the business. So that stays as it is. As it's going to be," he corrected himself. "Mainly, I got two things to do. First, I see that I get a legal deed to land in the FDR range all around the Henry Wallace area, and that deed will predate old man Boland's deed by several weeks. So the hell with the old speculator flying out here from Earth. When he does come, weeks from now, he'll discover the land's been bought. Trip all the way here and back for nothing. Maybe he'll have a heart attack." Arnie chuckled, thinking about that. Too bad. And then the other thing, Jack Bolin himself. "I'm going to fix him," he said to himself. "A guy I haven't met yet, that doesn't know me, although I know him. What I am to Jack Bolin now is fate."
"Good morning, Mr. Cott."
Annoyed at having his meditation interrupted, he glanced up and saw that a girl had entered the room and was standing by his desk expectantly. He did not recognize her, a girl from the secretary pool, he realized, come to take the morning's dictation. "Call me Arnie," he muttered. "Everybody's supposed to call me that. How come you didn't know? You knew around here?" The girl, he thought, was not too good-looking, and he returned to his newspaper. But on the other hand, she had a heavy, full figure, the black silk dress she wore. "There isn't much on under that," he said to himself as he observed her around the side of the newspaper. Not married. He saw no wedding ring on her finger. "Come over here," he said. "You scared me because I'm the famous great Arnie Cott in charge of this whole place?" The girl approached in a luxuriant sidling motion that surprised him. She seemed to creep sideways over to the desk. And in an insinuating, hoarse voice, she said, "No, Arnie, I'm not scared of you." Her blunt stare did not seem to be one of innocence. On the contrary, its implied knowledge jolted him. It seemed to him as if she were conscious of every whim and urge in him, especially those that applied to her. "You've been working here long?" he asked.
No, Arnie.
She moved closer now and rested against the edge of the desk so that one leg, he could hardly believe it, gradually came into contact with his own. Methodically, her leg undulated against his own in a simple, reflexive, rhythmic way that made him recoil and say weakly, "Hey."
"What's the matter, Arnie?"
the girl said, and smiled. It was a smile like nothing he had ever seen in his life before, cold and yet full of intimation, utterly without warmth, as if a machine had stamped it there, constructed it by pattern out of lips, teeth, tongue. And yet it swamped him with its sensuality. It poured forth a saturated, sopping heat that made him sit rigid in his chair, unable to look away. Mostly it was the tongue, he thought. It vibrated. The end, he noticed, had a pointed quality, as if it was good at cutting, a tongue that could hurt, that enjoyed slitting into something alive, tormenting it, and making it beg for mercy. That was the part it liked most, to hear the pleas. The teeth, too, white and sharp, made for rending. He shivered.
"Do I bother you, Arnie?"
the girl murmured. She had, by degrees, slid her body along the desk so that now, he could not understand how it had been accomplished, she rested almost entirely against him. "My God," he thought, "she's..." It was impossible. "Listen," he said, swallowing and finding his throat dry. He could hardly croak out the words. "Get going and let me read my newspaper." Grabbing up the paper, he held it between himself and her. "Go on," he said gratingly. The shape ebbed a little.
"What's the matter, Arnie?"
Her voice purred, like metal wheels rubbing, an automatic sound coming forth from her, like on a recording, he thought. He said nothing. He gripped his paper and read. When he next looked up, the girl had gone. He was alone. "I don't remember that," he said to himself, quaking inside, down deep within his stomach. "What kind of a creature was that? I don't get it. What was happening just then?" He began automatically to read an item in the paper about a ship which had been lost in deep space, a freighter from Japan carrying a cargo of bicycles. He felt amused, even though 300 people aboard had perished. It was just too goddamn funny, the idea of all those thousands of little light Jap bikes floating as debris, circling the sun forever. Not that they weren't needed on Mars with its virtual lack of power sources. A man could pedal free of cost for hundreds of miles in the planet's slight gravity. Reading further, he came across an item about a reception at the White House for... He squinted. The words seemed to run together. He could hardly read them. Printing error of some kind? What did it say? He held the newspaper closer. "Gobble, gobble," it said. The article became meaningless, nothing but the gobble, gobble words one after another. Good grief. He stared at it in disgust, his stomach reacting. His duodenal ulcer hurt worse than ever now. He had become tense and angry, the worst possible combination for an ulcer patient, especially at mealtime. "Darn those gobble-gobble words," he said to himself. "That's what that kid says. They sure spoil the article in the paper." Glancing through the paper, he saw that almost all the articles devolved into nonsense, became blurred after a line or so. His irritation grew, and he tossed the paper away. "What the hell good is it like that?" he asked himself. "That's that schizophrenia talk," he realized. "Private language. I don't like that here at all. It's okay if he wants to talk like that himself, but it doesn't belong here. He's got no right to push that stuff into my world." And then Arnie thought, of course, he did bring me back here, so maybe he thinks that does give him the right. Maybe the boy thinks of this as his world. That thought did not please Arnie. He wished it had never come to him. Getting up from his desk, he went over to the window and looked down at the street of Lewistown far below. People hurrying along, how fast they went. And the cars, too. Why so fast? There was an unpleasant kinetic quality to their movements, a jerkiness. They seemed either to bang into one another or to be about to. Colliding objects like billiard balls, hard and dangerous. The buildings, he noticed, seemed to bristle with sharp corners. And yet, when he tried to pinpoint the change, and it was a change, no doubt of that, he could not. This was the familiar scene he saw every day. And yet, were they moving too fast? Was that it? No, it was deeper than that. There was an omnipresent hostility in everything. Things did not merely collide. They struck one another, as if doing it deliberately. And then he saw something else, something which made him gasp. The people on the street below, hurrying back and forth, had almost no faces,
just fragments or remnants of faces, as if they had never formed.
Oh, this will never do, Arnie said to himself. He felt fear now, deeply and intensely.
What's going on? What are they handing me?
He returned, shaken, to his desk and sat down again. Picking up his cup of coffee, he drank, trying to forget the scene below, trying to resume his routine of the morning. The coffee had a bitter, acrid, foreign taste to it, and he had to set the cup back down at once. I suppose the kid imagines all the time he's being poisoned, Arnie thought in desperation. Is that it? I gotta find myself eating awful-tasting food because of his delusions? God, he thought, that's terrible. Best thing for me, he decided, is to get my task here done as fast as possible and then get back to the present.